Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of the one and only Prince. The Purple One was an American singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, poet, cultural icon, and is widely regarded as one of the best musicians of his generation. In this episode, we'll largely focus on Prince's lyricism as well as his profound impact on American writing, music, and culture at large. Today we are joined by C. Lee McInnes and Carrie Black. Their detailed bios can be found in the show notes. McInnes and Black are interviewed by Linda Dunleavy, Director of Development at the American Writers Museum and fellow Minnesota native.
Hello, and welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm Linda Dunleavy, Director of Development at the American Writers Museum, and I'm happy to be here with C. Lee and Carrie and all the Prince fans out there. Thank you for listening. There's really so much that you could potentially discuss about Prince, but since we're the American Writers Museum and our guests have specific knowledge, we're going to try to focus on a couple of areas. Prince's writing, and also Prince, the immersive experience that just opened in Chicago as a way of experiencing and learning about Prince. So to start off, I'll ask you both to just tell us a little bit about yourselves and your work in this area and Prince's significance to you personally. Celie, do you want to start?
Sure. I am a poet and short story writer from Clarksville, Mississippi, home of the blues. Woohoo! I recently took an early retirement from Jackson State University, the I Love, to complete three manuscripts, a poetry collection, short story collection, and an essay collection. Other than that, I'm still publishing poems and short stories in journals and anthologies, and just published two poems in a newly released anthology, Black Fire This Time, edited by Dr. Kim McMillan. That's it.
And I'm Carrie Black. I'm a co-founder at Superfly, we produce events. We've, well-known for creating music festivals. We created Bonnaroo, and we do Outside Lands in San Francisco. And we also have been doing immersive experiences in more recent years. We do them around the TV show Friends and The Office, and just launched the Prince, the Immersive Experience as well.
Yes, and I had an opportunity to go to the Prince, the Immersive Experience, and it was so fun. So I'm glad I got to go, and that'll help, hopefully help our discussion. It was really fun. I recommend it. Everyone should go. It'll be in Chicago till about October, right?
October 9th.
Yeah. All right. So both of you have been immersed in Prince. And in your work, I mean, you've certainly learned so much about him. And I wonder if you can just share some of what you think is most profound or inspiring about Prince and how he remains relevant today. Celie, what do you think?
He has a song for all circumstances and occasions, right? Unlike most, Prince understood that human beings are like pie charts. So you tell my students that human beings are pie charts with many slices. And while most people only focus on two or three of those slices of their human chart, Prince was determined to learn and engage all the slices of his human being, which enabled him to write, say, nuanced and complex songs, both musically and lyrically, that appeal and resonate on multiple levels. So for instance, say his first album has a song, Baby, about an unwed couple, you know, facing an unintended pregnancy. Like, who writes a song about that? And Prince presents the male persona as someone who represents the full spectrum of emotions, shock, fear, doubt, acceptance, responsibility. Yet the lyrics provide a blueprint for accepting your responsibility, right? It begins first, you know, baby, what are we going to do? I barely make enough money for two. But then in the end, he says, you know, we're going to work it out. I hope my baby has eyes just like you. So like most of his songs, this is a song for real life that shows the human capacity for overcoming the difficult and creating beauty. So that's what makes him relevant, is he has a song for every occasion.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Carrie?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that's so inspirational to me about him is that, you know, he was, you know, just a consummate workaholic. And it's like that, you know, inspiration to kind of just work so hard on every aspect of his career, you know, is really amazing. I mean, he did everything from, you know, writing the lyrics to playing all the instruments to doing his wardrobe to the performance. I mean, literally everything. I think, you know, he also, you know, with his writing itself, you know, is really from the heart. You know, he would say that if you want to get to know him, you just need to listen to his music, right? And I think kind of like you were saying, like that, you know, you could see all of his different sides in his music, from his spiritual side to his romantic side and, of course, his party side. So, you know, there's just stuff for everyone to connect with even still.
Yeah, I agree. And when you go through Prince, the immersive experience, you really get that. It's so multifaceted. The way he expressed himself, from the fashion to the, I mean, I did not even realize there were so many albums. And then, you know, you have the takeaway after you leave, you just are like, oh my gosh, I have so much homework, all these albums I need to listen to and all this that I need to explore. You know, and same with his writing and his lyrics. It's, if you only listen to top tracks, you're, it's a disservice to yourself because there's so much.
Absolutely. That's why there's one part of the experience. We have these kiosks where you answer some questions and you get some personalized track and a little playlist to go listen to later. And the idea is there's no songs on there are the hits. There's no hits. It's all deep cuts and from some of the vault tracks that they've released over the past bunch of years, with the whole idea of, you know, being able to get people to go deeper into his music and discover music they didn't know about. That's been one of the most amazing parts for me through this whole experience of building this thing, which is getting to know all of those different tracks. And I feel so much better for it.
Yeah. And the sound is great. So I did that. I loved it. And because of that, I've been diving into the Crystal Ball album, which I love.
It is amazing.
Yeah, it really, it just sends you away with like so much more to go discover. Well, okay. So Celie, I want to ask you if you, in your research, if you, have learned much about Prince's writing process, you know, his writing style. What's unique about him as a writer?
Well, longtime band member Morris Hayes, right, who was the longest tenured member in Prince's band, once asked Prince, "So, what do you think you did best?" Right, and Prince said, "Quote: At the end of the day, I'm a songwriter. I'm a poet. No one reads anymore. For me, the biggest thing is my lyrics." End quote. And so Morris Hayes didn't agree with that. He said that you could pick any area. You may not like the keyboard sound or the drum sound or whatever, but when you strip all the music from that, he was always clever, right? And I can attest to Prince being well-read, because that was the foundation of our conversations that we had the 18 months that he and I worked together. So when you also understand that we have tens, if not hundreds, of notebooks with Prince's lyrics, and it seems that Prince often began with a lyrical idea, wrote the poem or story completely, and then composed the music. Of course, I'm open to the notion that he probably had the music in his head as he was composing lyrics. Most poets work with a rhythm that they're crafting their poems. Words are merely like sounds with meaning. So just as more traditional poets craft poems based on rhythm, including syllabication, meter rhyming, and alliteration, I'm sure Prince had some notion of the music in his head he was crafting while he was writing the lyrics, but it seems that Prince was always interested in having something to say as a lyricist first, right? And then adding that as a musician, right? His first, I remember the reviews of the album Graffiti Bridge, and when the reviews were coming out, Prince said, "They're not mentioning the lyrics. I should have included the lyric sheet." So clearly Prince was driven by having something to say, and that drove him to paint the most vivid and sometimes shocking image to etch his ideas in our minds and hearts. So I think it began with the lyrics, and he painted the music around it.
Yeah. Okay. So what did he like to read?
he read some of everything. So like the 18 months we were together, it was everything from Miseducation of a Negro to what was some of the other stuff he read? Of course, the autobiography of Malcolm X. He read a lot of Martin Luther King's readings. One story I tell is that I had to get him off that Ayn Rand cliff, though. Right? When I first met him, he was on that Ayn Rand cliff, Atlas Shrugged. I was like, "Nah, brother, come on back, come on." But you have to realize why he was on that cliff. Remember, at the time, he's battling Warner Brothers, right? And so he's seeing what Ayn Rand is saying about the bureaucrats taking advantage of the individuals, right? The bureaucrats stifling the individual. So that's all that he's seeing in Ayn Rand. Like, no, but there's some other kind of oppressive, racist, classist stuff that Ayn Rand has in there that you want to come off that ledge. So he was well read. And he would never say I was wrong. He would come back and go, I rethought that Ayn Rand thing. And yeah, I'm sure I can get somewhere else on that. And that was cool for me. But like I said, autobiography from Malcolm X. He read a lot of Baldwin. He read a lot, of course, about musicians. So, of course, not only was he listening to James Brown and Jimi Hendrix and Smokey Robinson, he was reading a lot. And that was the one thing that the music told us that he was well-read. The music told us that he had an eye for society. And then meeting and talking to him, he was basically a walking library of books and articles.
Cool. I didn't realize that you had worked with him directly.
Yeah, it was, I'll just say quickly, it was the most fun and strange 18 months. He would call after midnight, and this was back. Remember when call ID was that little box? Mm-hmm. So there's nobody else in Chanhassen, Minnesota. So we had that one phone with the long cord that stretched all through. And I would always be in my office, and so my wife would answer the phone. He wouldn't say anything. And he would do it two or three times. So she would say, hello, hello, hello. And it's Chanhassen, Minnesota, dude. It can't be anybody else. So he wouldn't say anything. And like after about two or three hellos, he would hang up and would call back less than 2 minutes later. And then I would pick up the phone, and he would start talking like none of that had happened. Like, are you busy, right? And so my wife, being my wife, was like, oh, okay, let's do this. And so when he would call, and she would, because I would always be in my office, so I couldn't get the phone, she would just go, hello, 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 hello. And he would hang up. He would call back. I'd pick up the phone. He'd go, your wife's funny. Like, really? that's what you have. That's what you're getting from this. So yeah, so it was a lot of that. And I'll just say that he was hiring me to write a book, and he had just converted to being a Jehovah's Witness. And so he wanted to write a book about religion, music, and politics, that trinity being part of being the core of Black civil rights movement. Unfortunately, the book companies wanted to tell our book about the people with whom he had sex. And so we finished a chapter and had all of the table of contents. But once it became clear that they didn't want this book from him, you know how his mind works, he was on to the next thing. But so we got to talk a lot about a lot of different things. And but I look well-read, funny.
Oh, I love that.
I love that he could get his inspiration from a lot of places too. I mean, one of the stories that I found out during this process that I love is, the song 1999, which sounds like just a super fun party song, which most people think it is. It's from him watching a Nostradamus special about the end of the world. It's when he got the inspiration for that song. He's a very amazing, like you said, poet and lyricist first off.
Yeah. And, there are some images of his handwritten lyrics in the immersive experience, which is so great to see, just to see it in their handwriting.
And to see the countless editing, right? I think that's something that young writers, right, whether you are, songwriter or a poet or a short story writer, one of the things to get young writers to do is to embrace editing, right? To embrace the notion that you have to do it over and over and over again. One of my favorite lines from a movie about a writer is that they thought he had written 30 pages, and the writer said, no, I didn't write 30 pages. I wrote one page 30 times. And if you look at like all of the scratch throughs and notations that you have, he was always thinking about, can I say this better?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got mine, but I'm going to ask yours first. Do you have a favorite passage or lyric?
Let me let the good brother go while I think of mine. I've been trying to think about this for a minute.
This is just one that came off the top of my head. I don't know if it's my favorite, but one that I've loved recently. There's an unreleased track called Call to the Wild that I've been listening to and loving. And there's just a line in there that says, "We play it loud, so we play it loud so they know we're alive." And I just have always love that quote and that inspirational moment.
Yeah, that's a great one. I'll do two quick ones. One is Black Muse from Black Muse, when he says, Black Muse, we're going to make it through. Truly people who created rhythm and blues, rock and roll and jazz, we're built to last. Like, I like that one, but I also love the lyric from The Exodus has Begun, when he says, spatchcocks and blackface offer us pennies when it's millions of millions and millions that they reap. How in the world can we call ourselves equal when their wages outweigh the time that they keep if they stood up and behave like the humans they're supposed to, as opposed to the way they are not? Then this new power soul would not be so soulful, and the water they were in would not be so hot. Every time I hear those words, it prepares me for a revolution, for an exodus. And he wrote that when he was in the midst of his battle with Warner Brothers, but then contextually, right, it's about those wages and the way that artists were always ripped off. And so, yeah, that's those two, I think I return to a lot.
Yeah, wow, you make it sound so beautiful and poetic too. It's that, they're words that are meant to be spoken too, as well as sung. Yeah, right. Well, so you were talking about the struggle with Warner Brothers, and my favorite Prince song is My Name is Prince. And I just love the audacity of it. And he says, you know, I know from righteous, I know from sin, I got two sides and they're both friends. And I feel like, you know, that song too, is it was sort of at the time, it was on the Love Symbol album, when he's just getting away from Warner Brothers and that, and just, you know, saying loudly to the world, like, hey, I am Prince, you know, and,
You know, what's cool about that song that you picked, that one, kind of like Exodus Has Begun and many others, Prince was a master of either combining or troping the individual I with the collective I, right? So that if you break down My Name is Prince, it's both an individual speaker, but he's also speaking collectively for a group, right? If you take that, say, the Sacrifice of Victor, there's an individual I, right, that whatever that persona is, and then it becomes that logical kind of, that larger kind of African-American eye. So I always love the fact that Prince was always layering his meanings by playing with how he was using the pronoun I. And sometimes I meant an individual speaker, and sometimes I meant a group, but at all times it was giving the poem some weight and intensity about making it more metaphoric, that all our individual things are also collective things, which allows us to kind of see and connect with people on a larger realm, if that makes sense.
Right. And that kind of leads me to another thing. So you say in your book, Seeley, that Prince has single-handedly affected a total change of the mass populace's ideas and beliefs of sexuality, racism, and religion. And I agree. And I think about, like, Prince being from Minnesota, for one thing, and his ability and propensity to comment on current events. And I wonder if you ever think about, like, you know, how Prince would have responded in the last 6 years. You know, Minneapolis, his hometown, has become a different place, you know, and like the murder of George Floyd, it's just, that was a defining event. Things are changing. And, you know, how do you think Prince would have responded to that, to those, you know, current events and things in his own town?
That's a good question. I think that he would be engaging it the same way, by developing and expanding himself, his religious, economic, social, political notions about the world, and allowing those notions to be expressed in his work, right? However, the most difficult point to understand about Prince, even for longtime fans, is that Prince forthrightly believed what he believed until he believed something else, right? And while many see that as being hypocritical or contradictory, I see that as a person being concerned with growing and evolving, allowing his knowledge to impact his growth, and then allowing that progression to drive his art. So that as Prince was consuming, like we are, like when we consume something, we are not who we were 5 years later or 10 years later. So as Prince would grow, right, his music would change and grow. So I think that in the same way that he wrote Baltimore, right, the same way he wrote some other things, he would have written something addressing that. It may not have been, say, how he would have done it 5 years ago, but as the music would have reflected not only him thinking about the particular issue, but how his overall ideology demands that he responds to that issue.
And the amazing thing is that he, they just put out the Welcome to America record, which sounded like he could have written it right now, but he wrote it in 2010, which I thought was really, incredible and prophetic.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it, I mean, it's what true artists do. They're constantly evolving, you know, his look, his music, his opinions, you know, everything. And that's what you really see in Prince, the immersive experience, when you see how his wardrobe evolved, you know, and just the evolution of how he presented himself. You really experience that. You get to see all pieces of the pie, you know, like all of the sides of him and all of the ways that he expressed himself.
And Prince was just to add to that, Prince was a semiotician, right? He was a real semiotician, right? We talk about him being a dandy, but I think also along with Prince being a dandy, he was a semiotician. And what both of you guys are saying, that Matt Fink said that he knew the music was going to change when Prince had a new hairdo, right? And so while people may take that as just being a cosmetic thing, that's an artist thinking about the best way to present his work, right? That those of us who are artists understand that the artistry has to be told. So Prince understood that hair, clothing, right, fashion, everything that he did was an embodiment. And he was one of those, well, not one of those stories, but he was also in a generation where the visual became as important, right? We all familiar with that song, Video Killed the Radio Star. Well, Prince was at the precipice of the video age and understanding that not only am I going to communicate through sound and through lyrics, I also get to communicate visually. And to really think about videos later on as mini movies to actually supplement a message.
Exactly. Yeah. People like David Bowie, Madonna.
Yes.
It just makes it just like a delight and like a multi-sensory experience. Just you're listening to them, you're looking at them. It's just a whole experience. Well, Carrie, can you talk to us a little bit about creating Prince the Immersive Experience, what your goals were and what it was like to work with the Prince Estate?
Yeah. I mean, it was daunting in the fact that I was trying to create something that, you know, I wanted to create something that, you know, I think Prince would have been proud of and would have, you know, enjoyed himself. So, you know, it was a two to two and a half year long process, but it was amazing. We worked hand in hand with the estate. They really brought us into his world, introducing us to all sorts of people that he worked with, creatively and otherwise, to really help us, you know, authenticate and make sure that it was something that, you know, the Purple One himself would have approved of. So, you know, we worked with Randy St. Nicholas, and there's actually some never before seen photos of hers in the experience. We worked with Roy Bennett, who was his lighting director in the 80s and 90s. He worked on a whole, you know, sort of DJ lighting audiovisual show in the experience. So, you know, they were tremendously helpful and great to work with throughout to create something that we really felt was authentic.
Yeah. So I don't want to give too much away, but I used to go to Glam Slam in the early 90s. And it was so fun just to see Glam Slam and just go in there and start dancing. And just, it was so, I thought that was brilliant. And, you know, the people who were in there with me dancing, it was just as fun as being there. I mean, people were just so immersed. That's like the best word for it.
Yeah.
And I got to think that Prince would have been very happy to just have a room that is just for dancing.
Yeah, there couldn't be a Prince-related experience and not have a chance to just enjoy the music and party a little bit. So had to do it.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's talk about how Prince transformed songwriting and transformed music. He created the Minneapolis sound, you know, that sort of, you know, what he did to transform the music landscape.
You know, I think, you know, for him, you know, he was really trying to change the game in terms of like really being just a musician creating music, not like one genre. I know from early on, he was always trying to show his wide range of influences. Obviously, as we know, he was influenced by James Brown and Jimi Hendrix and Santana and all these different people. And he never wanted to just, you know, just be R&B or just be this kind of thing. He was, even on his very first album, you know, even had like a 70s arena rock style song in I'm Yours. And, you know, I think he was always just trying to, you know, take in all of his influences and create something new, and which is always exhilarating.
Yeah, I think Brother Carrison is right on, right? Like blending those, and he did it both musically and lyrically, right? So blending, like look at some of the songs. So like Crazy You and So Blue from the first album. That's a gumbo of Smokey Robinson, Minnie Riperton, and Joni Mitchell, right? The end of Just As Long As We're Together. That's Stevie Wonder's Contusion with less jazz and more James Brown coordination. The lyrics in Horny Toad, that's the reincarnation of Little Richard. I'm Yours is a manifestation of Prince's theoretical assertion, right? That what he said, I like rock and roll, but I like my rock and roll funky, as it channels Jimi Hendrix through Pop and Funkadelic. Temptation, right? That's Prince reminding us that Jimi Hendrix thought that B.B. King and Muddy Waters were the greatest guitar players of all time. Yet Let's Go Crazy is a combination of Little Richard and Jimi Hendrix extending through the root of Muddy Waters, right? As Muddy Waters declared, the story longs to be told, the blues had a baby and they called it rock and roll, right? And then all of this culminates in the When Doves Cry, which is something historically that had never existed before. But then even lyrically, right? Prince is Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, George Clinton, right? That a real poet serves every aspect of humanity and does not choose either to be a romance or a political poet, right? Think about songs like Controversy and If I Would Die, Controversy and If I Was Your Girlfriend. He challenges what it means to be a heterosexual male. in songs such as Sexuality, Race, and Family Name. He challenges the man-made arbitrary notions of race. In Any Christian, right? Dance Electric, The Everlasting Now. He asserts about the ills of the flesh really being ills of the spiritual manifesting in the flesh, right? Songs like I Will Die For You in one song. He challenges what it means to be a physical and metaphysical being. And then all of it culminates in songs like Color and Don't Play Me and Radical Man 2045, which he fights against the limitations that the music industry placed on Black people in general. So like, you know, Brother Carrison said, Prince was, he did what T.S. Eliot said, right? T.S. Eliot says in his seminal essay, Tradition and the Individual Artist, master what came before you and then create your own niche of unique creativity. And I think that that's why he resonates today, because he knocked open doors to say you can kind of do whatever you want to do it as long as you master everything that comes before you.
Yeah, and so there's the past, and then, you know, I feel like the influence of Prince lives on in artists today. You know, I try to tell my son who likes rap, like, don't you understand? Like, all of those people that you listen to, they think Prince is God, but you know, it's like, you know, they get it, but the kids don't always, you know, now it's getting to be old to them, you know, but certainly, I mean, you can see his influence in contemporary musicians too, right?
Yeah. I think you can see it, especially people like Lenny Kravitz, Andre 3000, Janelle Monáe, Her, Maxwell. I think that the real problem is that a lot of young people think that wearing a Purple Rain t-shirt is paying tribute to Prince, when that's a really shallow and cosmetic way of paying honor to him. I think the best way to pay tribute to Prince is to dedicate oneself to your craft, right? In the same way that Prince even pushed himself. I have a very unpopular opinion, but I just think that sampling, though it's creative, sampling to a degree destroyed Black musicianship. Now you have to relate that to Reaganomics and Ronald Reagan cutting funding to public arts programs. And so once Reagan cut funding to public arts program, African-American children had less access to instruments. But when you think about that notion of what sampling has done to Black musicianship, I want to see on the charts more guitar players, more bass players, right? More piano players. That's what's missing from music. And I think that to really talk about the other than those people that I mentioned, how do we get young people in general, but particularly more young Black people playing instruments actually on record and playing live? And that would be continuing the legacy of Prince.
Absolutely. And you know, one thing I learned in the immersive experience is about Prince's philanthropy. He did it anonymously. He did not make a big deal about it, but that was one of the things that he was dedicated to, is helping kids get the opportunity to be creative and play music, right? Mm-hmm. Carrie, do you know more? But I mean, you probably had to do some research about that.
Yeah, he, like you said, he was very quiet about his philanthropy, but he was always doing things. I mean, even the infamous show where they at First Avenue in Minneapolis, where he recorded the songs that would later become Purple Rain on the album, Let's Go Crazy and some others. That show was a benefit show, which no one, you know, really knows about. Obviously, like you said, he was, you know, quietly investing in things like Yes, We Code, even early Black Lives Matter. And so, you know, he was just doing it in his own way, you know, not flashy, but that was, you know, that was just who he was.
And even with the Marvin Collins School, right? He was one of those first people to step back there to really talk about looking at alternative ways of educating and putting your money where your mouth was. And I know he talked a lot about Paisley Park, not necessarily becoming a museum, but becoming a space where local Minneapolis students could record, right? And I think that's one of the things that kind of needs to be the next step in what they're doing. And again, you know, far be it for me to tell the state how to conduct their business, but you know, he mentioned to me and many other people that he had planned to offer free studio time to local Minneapolis youth, because that was one of the things that he got as a local Minneapolis youth from the Way. Of course, we all know about the center, the Way, and then later with Chris Moon and others. And that's, I think, something that's also missing for inner city youth, is being able to get to a studio to really understand what it means to record a record. So I think that would also continue his legacy of philanthropy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because you never know when the next Prince is out there.
Right.
They're out there right now.
Indeed.
They need opportunities, so.
It is an amazing thing. I mean, they do tours of Paisley Park, and which I highly recommend. It's just, you know, seeing where he, you know, lived and created all that music. It's an incredible experience to go through and see, and, you know, soak in the Prince vibes, because there it's throughout, you know, and the art that's around and secret doors. And I mean, it's just
right.
So cool. I haven't been there, but I'm going back to Minnesota in August. I'm going to go check out the shoes. That's the exhibit right now.
Incredible.
300 pairs of amazing shoes. Okay, Celie, another thing that you say in your book, and you're talking about, you know, Prince's writing and his voice, and you say that Prince had the secret to reconstructing reality, and that's what made him a metaphysical poet. I don't disagree, but can you elaborate on that?
So from For You, his first album, to Parade, Prince's lyrics are promoting the creation of a raceless, genderless, classless utopia, right? Where ideas and ideals are the essence of life, like much like Plato's Republic. As such, the secret to reconstructing reality is not accepting someone else's definition of oneself, and also kind of defining and embracing one's own definition of oneself, right? In Party Up, Prince asks, right, why should young people fight wars started by old people? In Sexuality, Prince defines, you know, he declares that those who want to be free from other people's illusions of race, gender, and class simply must declare themselves free and define themselves accordingly, right? He says, quote, you don't need no money, you don't need no clothes, we don't need no segregation, we don't need no race, reproduction of a new breed, lead to stand up and organize, right? Self-definition is the only secret, or is only a secret, because from birth, most humans are taught to just be aware of other people's definitions, right? That to follow other people's notions of right and wrong and their notion of normal and abnormal, right? And Prince was saying that you don't have to be accepted by those definitions, that because there's not safety in numbers, right? We're taught there's safety in numbers. And what Prince was saying is that that so-called safety is an illusion to confine, and that self-love and individuality are the tools to liberate oneself from that being confined.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. You said it much better. And that's why he's such an inspiration. You know, he inspires you to be, you know, like, no, look at those rules. Do they make sense? And whether it's the rules of how to dress or anything, you know, just, you know,
exactly.
Be courageous and be yourself. And that's, you know, that's the most beautiful. All right. So in my diving on Prince, I rewatched the episode. I know you know this. This is kind of silly, but when he was a guest on The Muppets Tonight, oh my goodness. So I know that a lot of, you know, clips of that were going around after he died, but to watch the whole 22-minute episode, the whole thing is so awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, you see Prince in just, you're just like, it's kind of like when a celebrity goes on Sesame Street, you see a whole other side of them, and it is so funny and delightful and charming. And you just, you feel like you're just seeing Prince as like, just a person. And yet he's still totally Prince.
You know what's really cool about that for me is that you also think about the two songs that he chose. And both of those songs, when you don't think about it, are very message oriented.
Yep.
Right. Starfish and Coffee, though we know the backstory that it was written, Susanna had a, you know, classmate and all of that. But the lyrics of Starfish and Coffee are really about being an individual. But what I love about that song is Prince kind of flips it on us, because if you listen to the lyrics, like, we expect him to be the individual. But in the lyrics, he was part of the classmates that was making fun of the girl who was different. And the message in that is, be careful of your own self, because in fighting for your own individuality, don't be the person who's trying to oppress somebody else's individuality, right? And so that's what I really love. And so on the Muppet Show, you're getting this message about not only it's okay to be an individual, but watch how you engage with other people, because you may be oppressing somebody and don't even know it. And then the other song, She Gave Her Angels, yes. That to me is like, that's one of the most beautiful songs, because true love is about giving, right? And what does she give? She gives her angels. And I'm here to tell you, Sister Linda and Brother Kerrison, I love my wife, but she ain't getting my angels. I mean, I'm going to keep my angels. I mean, she can get everything else, right? But I mean, it is, I would die for you, take it to a whole nother level, where what he's really saying in that song is, you can't really say you love somebody if you're not willing to give your whole self to them. So, like you say, in a 22-minute span, He teaches about respect of person, individuality, and how do you define love, showing that he was a preeminent songwriter.
Yeah, and he's funny. And I love how they do, like, he make a little impromptu video for Starfish and Coffee with Muppets. And it's just, I don't know, it's just completely worth 22 minutes of your time. So everyone should watch it. But yeah, that's another song I just discovered. She Gave Her Angels. And yeah, I mean, what I think that song can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, which is the beauty of it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So one song that I've enjoyed getting to know is, and it gives you those little glimpses into who he was, is the song Purple Music. He's got some lyrics in there that are just so, you know, talking about, like, you know, him showing who he is in there. I mean, even the first line, don't need no reefer, don't need cocaine. Purple music does the same to my brain and I'm high, so high, you know, just flipping the doing drugs thing. And because he was not that guy, he was just really all about the music. And we were talking before about him, you know, just doing what, you know, being a full artist. He writes in there, ain't got no theory, ain't got no rules. I just let the purple music tell my body what to do. And I'm high, so high. That's just one of those songs that I've discovered recently that I think is really cool.
And what's cool about this song is it was between that and All the Critics Love You in New York, which was going to make the album, right? And what's cool, and it shows how prolific it was, neither one of those songs suck, right? Like, neither one of those songs. So, like, that's a real problem to have, right? Which one of these two great songs, which, by the way, have great messages, right? So that speaks even more, right? The fact that discovering that song, Purple Music, is, you know, again, great music, great lyrics. And then, as he used to say in his live show, so many songs, so little time, right? And then that song gets bumped because of the message of All the Critics Love You in New York.
Yep. Didn't get released until, what, you know, a few years ago. So
yeah, there you go.
Not involved for 20 whatever years.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that when you guys were mentioning that I just wanted to mention, particularly for the museum, was that, or just not just for the discussion and around the museum, is that I think that a lot of people may not be familiar with Dave Hill's book, Prince of Pop Life, and, you know, people are familiar with my book, The Lyrics of Prince, but also like Andrew Swanson's book, Got to Be Something Here. I think the three of us do a good job of positioning Prince squarely within and as a product of the Black community, right? I think it's important to note, because since Prince's death and even before, there's been a rush to make Prince something other than Black, or to cast him as some alien that landed on Earth from somewhere, you know, and as such, the combination of a segregated Black community that gave Prince his love and mastery of music, combined with Prince meeting white and Jewish folk, that enabled him to build his own style and reality, right? We can never forget that 7th Avenue, right? Which, you know, it wouldn't put Black acts on his main stage until Prince forced him to by becoming an undeniable talent. So Prince, it must be made clear that Prince was a product of a Black Minneapolis. And to suggest anything else is to minimize or marginalize the contribution of Black people to American culture.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and all of his colleagues, the musicians that he worked with, they were all part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of those things, you know, we were talking about his, you know, influences, and, you know, James Brown, obviously, it feels to me, is always like sort of the biggest one. And I think there's that story of him seeing James Brown as a child and just seeing how he commanded his band. And that was one of, you know, I think became one of his great strengths as a band leader, and finding great musicians you know, being able to create in that style. I think that line from James Brown is very, very obvious.
Yeah, it is very obvious. And, you know, and Prince, he seemed like such an incredibly hard worker. And, you know, I wonder if there were musicians that tried to work with him that just couldn't keep up.
Yeah, people would say that, you know, that was a time limit on how long you could work with Prince. They all would talk about how, you know, Prince would call you 1, 2, 3 in the morning. And, you know, you could do that for maybe 2 hours. You were never off, right? You were never, there's a line, I think, in the 3 Chainz of Gold video, or was it 3 Chainz? Yeah, the 3 Chainz of Gold video, where I think it's Tony M and someone said, I got a day off and I don't even know if I have a day off. But I think for me, in that 1985 interview with Rolling Stone, and I was 15, when Prince said, it's a quote that was seared in my brain and it drove me. He said, Prince said that when my friends were playing, I was working. When they were sleeping, I was jamming. Every morning they awoke, I had a new groove. That was it. Like, that was all, that affirmed, because, you know, sometimes when your parents teach you lessons, it just becomes a wop or wop wop in the background, right? So to have Prince affirm my parents' notion of work ethic, right? And to really teach me that work ethic is sometimes more important than talent. And that quote, and as you guys say, looking at him always making and working, it drove me as both a person and an artist that I knew that talent alone isn't what's important. It's what I do with my talent. It's what I'm willing to invest, how much time I'm willing to invest. And I think that's the other thing that we have to teach about Prince, is that his work ethic is really what drove him past a lot of his peers.
Yeah, and it's not just the talent, it is the work. And that's what makes him inspiring. I mean, you go through Prince the Immersive Experience and you come out thinking, I want to be a better person. I want to work harder. I want to be more creative. I mean, it gets like down in your bones somehow. So, you know, the experience does a good job of just putting Prince inside you.
Right on. That was our goal, is to really, you know, have people leave inspired by Prince and want to go out and, you know, kind of spread that message out in their everyday life. And glad you came out that way.
Yeah, and I think the title is a great title because, you know, of course, you guys are immersing people in Prince, in Prince's world, but it's also metaphoric in that Prince immersed himself in his love, right? He immersed himself, like Paisley Park was his world, music was his world, right? And so those of us, right, what's the adage? If you find something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And so Prince is teaching us to immerse ourselves in the thing that we love, and that you'll always be successful because you'll always be working diligently at it to improve that.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else that either of you is coming to mind?
I would just want to say that the other important thing is that as Prince spent the first half of his life being a metaphysical poet. And then the second half of his life, he kind of transitioned because he understood that this utopian world that I want to create, this raceless, classless, genderless world, he didn't turn his back on that, but he understood that I also need to be addressing the specific ills of African Americans. And so I think that we have to be aware that he began writing songs such as Color and You Will Be Moved and Money Don't Matter Tonight and Paris 179-843 on Uncle Sam and No Black Mother Effers in the House and the Exodus Has Begun and Black Muse and Free Yourself in Baltimore, Avalanche, Dear Mr. Man, because he understood that we can't have a quote utopian society if we don't deal with the specific ills and issues of oppression. And so I think that holistically, that where we began, right, is where we began about growth, right? That Prince was always growing and thinking about, if I'm trying to create this better world, there's no way we can create this better world if we don't address these real specific issues and make people uncomfortable sometimes, right? And I think that's the difference between an entertainer and an artist. I mean, they're synonymous terms, but an entertainer is more concerned about making you happy, whereas an artist is more concerned about creating something that challenges what you think of the world to create the catharsis to get something else from you. And I think while Prince wanted to entertain us, he wanted to create something that challenged us to make us ask ourselves why we accept the world as it is and can we change it? And I think he did a great job of doing that.
I agree. Yeah, and it doesn't hurt that he is the greatest entertainer and sort of gets everyone's attention. So there's nobody who doesn't like him, especially the whole state of Minnesota.
And there really was no one like him in terms of, like, you know, just someone who could really control every facet of their career. I mean, he wrote lyrics, played every instrument, the choreography, you know, the wardrobe that he oversaw, literally every facet. I don't think there's any artist who does all of those things at such a high level.
Yeah, absolutely. And starting at such a young age, it was clearly what he was born to do.
Yes.
And fortunately, he had the opportunity.
The audacity on his first record for Warner Brothers to demand that he do every instrument, play every instrument and produce it himself. I mean,
who in 1978 tells Maurice Starr, Irv Gwynn, and Fry, that's okay, I'm good, right? Right, Maurice Starr and Irv Gwynn and Fry, that's a god, right? Those are deities. and to go like, no, I'm good. I'm gonna handle this. Like you say, it's knowing who you are and being confident in who you are and embracing that vision to understand that only you can execute that particular vision. So
absolutely. All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for this very fun conversation. And I encourage everyone to, if you're in Chicago, go see Prince, the Immersive Experience, and, you know, dive into Prince. It's all good and it's all inspiring and it will make you a better person for it. So.
Amen.
Yeah. Thank you for the time.
All right.
I got people in Chicago and they've been talking really well about it. So.
Awesome.
Good. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank y'all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.